You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Calendar. Let's be real. Running a household can be exhausting and chaotic. And finding the perfect Mother's Day gift, it's not exactly a no-brainer. Until now. The Skylight Calendar is the best way to organize the family and give everyone, especially mom, some peace of mind to enjoy the things that matter most. The Skylight Calendar is a smart, touchscreen calendar that keeps track of and manages the chores, dinner planning, groceries, and to-dos for the whole family. The Skylight Calendar automatically syncs each family member's digital calendars and displays them all together on one color-coded touchscreen. It even doubles as a digital picture frame so you can finally share all those special moments that are just sitting on your phone. As a limited-time offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight calendar when you go to skylightcal.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTCAL.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightcal.com/easy.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting for Thursday, October 19th, the Poison Resentment Edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm an editor at Slate, and I'm the father of Leo, who is 3 years old, and Eliza, who is six.
I'm Rebecca Lavoy. I'm a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am the mother of Henry, who is 16, Teddy, who is 14, and a stepdaughter, Lily, who is 17.
And I am Carvel Wallace, a writer and editor out in Oakland, California, and I am father to Ezra, who is 14, and Georgia, who is 12.
Today on our show, we'll be talking to John Culhane, who writes Slate's Hey Daddy column, the parenting advice column from a gay dad about being one of his kids' two fathers. And we've got a question from a listener who's having trouble with her stepchildren's mother. Plus, as always, we'll have triumphs, we'll have fails, we'll have recommendations. And on Slate Plus, Slate editor Catherine Goldstein will share a spectacular recent parenting triumph. But first, our own triumphs and fails. Carvel, it's your turn. Go.
Yes, I have a triumph that is actually Joe's triumph, but I'm just so elated about it that because we've been working for years on this, I'm taking partial credit as a co-parent. Our son, Ezra, God bless him, has been, you know, he's a teenager and we have difficulties in the morning and general disorganization continues to be a needling factor in our lives because I forgot the lunch money. Now I have to come back home because now he's within sort of semi-walking distance to home. I have to come back. I forgot my clothes for theater and blah, 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 blah. And he's all this stuff. And he's always trying to like get one of us to rescue him and bring him stuff and bring him money for the bus because he forgot it and so forth. And we're just like, you know, if you just get the stuff ready in the evening before you go, then in the morning, you know. So I tend to be pretty hardcore about that. Like, nope, I'm at work. Good luck. Sorry you're not going to eat. Next time you'll remember to pack your lunch the night before. His mother tends to have a much harder time with that. And so I've sort of been like the coach, like, hey, you know, we had to draw these boundaries and he can figure it out, but he's not going to figure it out if we don't let him figure it out. He's capable of figuring it out. So this is an ongoing thing. Years we're into this. And Joe is working very hard to like find the right balance, because she feels so hurt when the kids don't have something that they need that it's really hard for her to just let them not have it and learn the lesson on their own. So it's common stuff for parents, nothing dramatic. Yesterday, he was a mess. He wasn't out of bed till 8 o'clock. I pick him up at 8 o'clock from school, from home. He wasn't even out of bed till 7:55. He came down to the car. His papers were flying everywhere. He was barefoot. I mean, it was a joke. So we get to school, whatever. And then he gets there and he immediately realizes he doesn't have money for lunch. He doesn't have food. He has rehearsal in the afternoon. He's not going to make it. So he decides to come home during the day where Joe is at work. Joe's working at home. So he comes home and then he tries to get Joe to drive him back to school. She's like, not going to do it. I'm working. Come on, Mom. Not going to do it. I'm working. So then Joe texts me like he's really pressuring me. I'm like, I mean, if you have to work, you have to work. You can get back to school. I mean, this is on him, but he's going to be late. Yeah, but that's his fault. He's going to be late because, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we go through this whole thing. Finally, she basically finds him the bus. She's like, this is the bus you're going to take. Here's your $2 for the bus. Go. So he then goes outside and then he starts to call her like, no, I can't take the bus. I'm going to be late. I'm going to be in trouble. And she refuses to answer the phone. And so she's texting me this whole time. And I'm like, I know this is difficult, but I mean, he's going to figure it out. So he waits on the front porch for like 10 minutes trying to get his mother to like rescue him, and she won't respond. So eventually he gives up. Next time we see him, she picks him up in the afternoon after rehearsal, evening, and he gets in the car and he goes, you know, Mom, this was hard for me, but I'm really glad that you did this, because I keep depending on you to like rescue me, and I don't know. I just feel like, when you do that, you do it, but then you're like mad at me, and it's just better if you don't do it. And I was like, she texted me this conversation third hand, and I was like, we'll see how this develops. Then this morning I go to pick him up. He gets in the car. He's got his shoes on. He's got his homework. He's there 5 minutes early. And he's like, Dad, from now on, I'm really going to try to get this together. I'm sorry that I've been like making everyone late. I don't want to make you late for school. I don't want to make Georgia late. It was like a complete 180. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I don't know. Just a moment of joy. I'll take pleasure in it, even if it's just this morning. Some success.
That's a parenting triumph for Joe, but for you, it's a sweet vindication.
Yeah.
No, because it wasn't like that she and I were arguing about it. Like, she understood the principle of it. She just was having a hard time executing. She needed me as third-party support to give her, you know what I'm saying? But yeah. It wasn't like we were fighting about it. Like, she gets it. She just, like, years ago, this was a kind of a little bit of a fight between us. And because I worked with teenage kids, especially teenage kids that were locked up and in jail I did that for many years. I have a pretty natural way of dealing with, like, recalcitrant teenagers, which is, I know that they actually do respond pretty well to boundaries, especially boys with men. They respond well to a certain kind of, like, line holding. It makes them, they resist it, but they kind of like it. It's a whole complex thing, but you get a feel for it. But so years ago, Joe and I would sort of go back and forth about this, but lately she's been on board. She's just facing how physically difficult it is, especially when he doesn't have lunch. That's the one that gets her, because she's like, my one job is to feed these kids. And I'm like, it is, but you are providing the food. You're doing your part. His part is to take the food with him. If he doesn't take it with him, that's on him. He's got it, you know, that has to be his thing. So I would say victories all around. I suspect they'll be short-lived because I'm a very cynical and experienced parent, but I'm appreciating it today.
All right. I have a failure, on the other hand. We are at a point where, as I've said before, I think probably on Slate Plus. So for those of you who are not Slate Plus members, join Slate Plus, you will already know that Eliza has learned to read. Only now wants to read all the time. Basically, like, can't get her to get up off the couch to have dinner or brush her teeth or anything because she's just sitting there reading, and she literally can't hear a word that you're saying because she's reading. So one thing that we have always done in the evening is, like, we read books to them before bed. It's just like a standard generic thing that you do is you read books and you get sick of the stupid kids' books that you have to read a million times. And now finally, Eliza is old enough to want to read interesting books, right? She's old enough where, like, she's interested in Harry Potter and she's interested in another post-Harry Potter series of, like, young adult or tween fantasy novellas or whatever. And we wind up alternating who does bedtime. Sometimes I'm home from work earlier. Sometimes my wife is home from work earlier. Sometimes we're both there, and then I'll do this kid, you do that kid. So there is no, the kids know that, like, you never quite know which parent is going to be putting you to bed, or sometimes it's a babysitter. And there's a certain amount of, like, no, I want whichever parent it is, I want the other parent to put me to bed, blah, blah, blah. In any case, I really like reading to them. It's like one of the sweet parts of parenthood, and I can see that pretty soon it's going to end, at least with Eliza, and I really want to keep it going. So we've been getting her a ton of books to read. My wife has been like ordering like batches and batches of like whatever well-reviewed or recommended books for this age group or whatever that she thinks she might like, because she goes through them so quickly. And we will start like reading one with her at bedtime, and then she'll take the book to bed with her, and by the next morning she's halfway through. Or she'll take it to school with her the next day, and then she doesn't want you to read it with her because she's almost at the end already. Or a thing that keeps happening, which is, although like she wants to read these exciting stories, she's still young enough that they're too scary for her. She was reading the first Harry Potter, and like 2/3 of the way through, where it gets to the like exciting action climax, she's like, nope, this is too scary for me. And she puts it down. And so what we've been unable to do is get any kind of consistent bedtime reading going with her. And the other night I got one of the new books that my wife had ordered that she was going to give to her, and it looked good. And I said, okay, this is going to be our bedtime book, and we're only going to read it like in the evening and just you and me. So every other night or every few nights, but we will read it together, and we will get to go on this exciting literary journey together. The book, incidentally, is called Escape from Mr. Lemoncello's Library by a guy called Chris Grabenstein. Seems like it's pretty good. We read the first two chapters. It seems fine. I definitely would have liked it when I was her age. But then she liked it too much, and the next morning she threw a fit, and she was like, oh, but I don't have anything to read, and I really want to take it to school, and otherwise I won't have anything to read at school, and there will be reading time, and I won't have anything to read, and then I'll have to, I don't know, engage with other children or do some arts and crafts or like whatever other stimulating activities they have for her. And I was like, fine, okay, you can take it home in your backpack. You can take it to school in your backpack. And she came home, and she was like, yep, now I'm nearly done. And now we will never read that book again. And I said, what do you want to do here? Are we done? Are you done with me reading to you? And she said, yeah, maybe instead of reading, we can just like have some quiet time on the couch or something like that. And so my parenting fail is that the sweet pleasure of reading stories to her in the evening is now, I guess, over for good. And soon the same thing will happen with Leo. And then that part of my life will be over. And I was unable to prevent it or forestall it. And that feels like a tragedy and a failure to me.
Aw.
Yeah.
That reminds me of, you know, Teddy used to like to like sneak into our bed and go to sleep at night, and then we have to carry him up, you know, that kind of thing. And then it just stops, and then you realize you didn't realize that the last time was the last time.
Yeah,
you know?
You never know.
It sucks. Totally sucks.
Yeah.
If I had been a little more forceful, I have to think, then I could have like made this the one special thing. But I just don't have the steel in my spine to do that when she wants to go to school. Rebecca, triumph or fail?
I have a triumph and a little warning. This is a little bit self-promotional, so I apologize for that part. But I hope you understand when I tell you why I'm pointing this out. I came out with a new podcast this week, and it had its first episode. It came out last week. And it was kind of a family affair because, as it turns out, you know, I'd kind of been working on the strategy around the releasing the end of it, the final production stuff, you know, talking to, you know, my ad agency and all this stuff, just trying to get the feed together and put it together. But it turns out when it came out, I was kind of looking back on the process and I realized this podcast was one of my kids' idea. Like, it was Teddy's idea. And throughout the process and working on it, it's been sort of like a piecemeal thing where I worked on it and then dropped it and then worked on it and then dropped it because of stuff that was going on in our lives. The kids actually produced some of it. Teddy's on it. Henry has done a ton of the audio production for it. And this episode that just came out, even though it's been done for a while, listening back to it, the kids were like actually interested in listening to it. And they're like never interested in reading or listening to anything that we do. You know, it's just kind of how it is when you're the children of journalists and media makers. It's like your kids have zero interest ever in hearing your voice or reading a single word that you ever wrote. But they actually are really into it because they worked on it and a lot of it was their idea. And so it's become kind of like a family project. And it's really the first time I've produced anything meant for, you know, large consumption that my kids worked on. And bonus, something I learned last week is my son Henry does do work for our little production company here, and we 1099 him, is that this qualifies him to start an IRA. So this is like the tip that goes with my triumph. If you have something that you do that's on the side and you can cut your kids a 1099, do it, even if it's them just sweeping the floor in your office, because then they can start a retirement account. So this is sort of a double triumph, is that we've, you know, been able to set up this little retirement thing that Henry can start thinking about, or that his parents can start thinking about, and a project that was, you know, of my kids' conception that they contributed to finally launched. It just feels really, really good, and it's really fun to put this thing out in the world that is actually a collaboration with my children. So that's my triumph.
That's awesome. Congratulations. Plug your podcast. What's it called?
Oh, that's right. I said it was self-promotional. It's called HGTV and Me. It's my conversations with people about the weird and strange and wonderful things that happen on HGTV shows. And it was completely Teddy's idea. So anyway, I'm really proud of it, and mostly because my kids' voices appear on it here and there. And because as when I listen back to it, it just feels like their fingerprints are on it. And it's kind of cool.
That's awesome. Mm.
Love it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Before we move on, let's do the business. We want to tell you about Pinna, Panoply's new audio app just for kids ages 4 to 12. Pinna features Peabody-winning original series, interactive game shows, irresistible audiobooks, popular podcasts, gripping adventures, enchanting bedtime stories, lively science and history shows, and much more. Subscribe to enjoy thousands of minutes of award-winning, critically acclaimed shows. Pinna frees kids from the small world of the screen and lets their imaginations take over. The human voice is the best way to communicate stories, and Pinna's programs are designed to spark the imagination and feed the mind without feeling guilty about keeping your children distracted with endless screen time. So check out Pinna on the iOS App Store or search for the Pinna feed wherever you get your podcasts. Also, Slate is putting on a really cool event in New York City on November 8th called The People vs. Trump Year One, featuring Slate writers Jamel Bowie, Isaac Chotiner, Dahlia Lithwick, and more. Hosted by editor-in-chief Julia Turner, it's a series of one-on-one conversations with people at the forefront of politics, media, the law, and activism as they compare notes on the lessons, challenges, and victories they've seen over the past year and talk about what they expect from the next. That's at 7:30 p.m. on November 8th at the New School Auditorium in Manhattan, New York. Go to slate.com/live for tickets and information. That's slate.com/live. In Slate Plus today, we will be talking to newly minted Slate editor Catherine Goldstein, who has a dramatic and spectacular parenting triumph that she wants to share with us. To hear that segment and to get ad-free versions of this and all other Slate podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program where fans of Slate and of our podcasts help support us and the work we do. If you enjoy this show, if you find it valuable, joining Slate Plus is a great way to support it. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing these shows. And of course, in return, you get extended ad-free versions of this show, other Slate shows, and a ton of other great benefits. So if you would like to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, let's go. John Culhane is a professor of constitutional law who also writes a column for Slate called Hey Daddy, a monthly feature exploring the joys and struggles of parenting from a gay father's perspective. John, thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So first, just tell us a bit about your family. Who are your kids? How old are they? And what kind of arrangement do you guys have?
All right. So this is an auspicious time for this conversation because I have twin daughters who just turned 13 yesterday. So we are launching into full teenage years right now. And my husband is actually, he has the same birthday. So all three of them had birthdays yesterday. So I'm still in a partial recovery mode from all of that. We adopted our kids. We've had them since they were tiny babies, and they're from here in Philadelphia. And my husband is a designer. He does kitchen work and bathroom work here in Philadelphia. So that's our family in a nutshell.
Well, since you bring it up, I should ask, why did you decide to adopt kids rather than having them through a surrogate or in some other way, and what sort of issues were there?
You know, it's hard to say exactly why we decided on adoption rather than surrogacy, except to say that we both kind of knew that's what we wanted to do from a point shortly after we met. We never really had much of a serious discussion about surrogacy. And then so the questions are, well, if you're going to adopt, are you going to do an international adoption or a private adoption or, you know, something for, through the public system? And we went to sort of an information session on various kinds of adoption. Well, actually, it was on various types of family formation. And one of the presenters was the then director of the Philadelphia, Human Services Department. And she made a very impassioned plea for people to adopt kids out of the dependency foster care system. And so we took that to heart. And we got on the list, and we expected that we would be adopting older kids because typically those are the kids, you know, who are in the system. But in this case, they called us and they said, we've got twins who are 2 months old who were in emergency foster care. They can't stay there. Are you willing to take them in? So we were foster parents for really over 2 years before our path was clear to adopt them because the mother still had, birth mother still had rights, and she was, you know, trying to get back with her kids, but it didn't work. So we took some emotional risk there, to say the least. So that's how it all happened. We did have some problems in addition to, you know, just the difficulty of adopting in that way, which is already kind of problematic. It was a longer process than it needed to be, a very emotional process. And you know, really, it's a hard enough process. And I do think about, you know, other families, particularly families headed by, you know, two men or two women that may have a similar experience and what they would have done. You know, it's not an ideal system, let's put it that way. And you really learn a lot about, you know, what matters to the courts and how the system really works. And I have to say, as a law professor who had practiced mostly in federal courts a long time ago, it was quite eye-opening to see kind of the disconnect between what I teach in a family law class and what actually goes on, you know, in real life, it was a little distressing, to say the least.
And do you think in cases where gay couples or gay families are trying to adopt, do you think this kind of prejudice is a common obstacle?
Not in Philadelphia. I don't think so. I think we were just sort of an anomalous case. You know, I think in Philly, people have seen enough of this. We didn't have any of this, by the way, from the social workers from the city, nor from the agency that the city commissions to kind of handle the day-to-day of the, foster care system. So, you know, I don't have the sense that it's that common in Philadelphia, although certainly in other parts of the state where this is, you know, less common, and certainly in other states, whatever the law might say, there are, you know, plenty of cases where, you know, things are just more difficult if you're a same-sex couple. That I think I can say with, you know, some confidence. And, you know, it did take us a while to get from, you know, foster to adopt, and under the circumstances, you know, way longer than it should have.
Now, I want to connect this to something that you wrote in a column for Slate about when your family had to do something that a lot of families have to go through, which is you had a dog that was biting people, that was dangerous, and you had to either euthanize or rehome the dog. And you write, I want to read something you wrote there. You wrote...
Let's hear it.
You wrote about talking to your kids about potentially euthanizing the dog. I think my dread of that conversation and my sense of vertigo over the whole process has something to do with my deep, though usually buried, sense that our family is contingent. The drawn-out difficulty of our adoption process, the personal history of anti-gay laws and attitudes, and the still visible differences between our family and our straight counterparts, these add up to a deep disquiet that percolates up through the ground during a seismic event. Is that something that you've talked to other gay parents about, that experience of the family as being maybe less stable and more contingent, and the way that might affect you at those difficult times in family life?
Yeah, you know, it's something very often doesn't come up. And as I said in the column, it's when you have a seismic event like that, that you really start to think about, well, you know, what is it that my own identity and experience kind of bring to this really difficult conversation? And, you know, there are cases where, you know, one couple that I know, two dads that moved out to somewhere near Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and they hadn't really had much, you know, to worry about or to think too deeply about in terms of their two daughters. And their family was created through surrogacy. But when they moved out there, they found that, you know, resistance from the local school board and things that were kind of going on behind the scenes, you know, made them feel as though their family was, and they were, you know, always very confident. They had a license plate that said two dads. They were always very confident that, you know, things were, you know, as sort of mainstream and assimilated as you can imagine. But then when you have an experience like that, and it doesn't even need to be sort of an anti-gay experience, it can be anything that is traumatic in some way and kind of reminds, at least for me, it reminds me of the difficulties that we, you know, have had. And I'm not trying to over-centralize this. I mean, obviously, you know, people can reach the same point and take the same steps coming from very different experiences, and we're all informed by those experiences. But I think, you know, for me anyway, when things like this happen, I do tend to at least incorporate some of those ideas about the contingency and the difficulty that kind of, you know, foregrounds whatever present experience we're having.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, you wrote in the column that I read of yours today, you know, after the dog column, you talked about, you know, meeting somebody in the park and the conversations you have that...
Oh, yeah, that one, yeah.
The conversations you have that, you know, aren't about being a gay dad and then suddenly are about being a gay dad.
Yeah, it's so strange, right? that was an interesting encounter. So this, for people who haven't read the column, and first of all, you know, why not? But that was a column where I talked about being in the dog park with our new dog, and having
congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And he's great. He can be at the dog park, and I can sort of exhale. Although he's got that hound in him, and he likes to sort of run. So sometimes he wants to just leave, like, the dog park and run out. So you have to make sure he's safely framed. But anyway, we're talking about schools because, you know, that's what parents do. So our kids are in the local public school, and this woman's daughter was in one of the private schools, and she was sort of complaining about it, that it wasn't rigorous enough. And, that's a conversation that, you know, a lot of, I guess, parents of privilege would have about, you know, they're not reading enough Shakespeare or any Shakespeare, or they're not doing, I don't know, differential equations in the seventh grade, right? So whatever it is. And because I was asking her about the school, our kids swim in that building, although they don't attend the school. So I was interested in what she thought. And she said, you know, I think if you're an LGBTQ parent, it might be okay, or if you're a minority. And then she listed all of these marginalized groups. And then she said, but if you are just a normal, and she did throw some air quotes around the word normal, family, and you're really trying to do the most for your kid, then it's not so good. And I thought, wow, that contains a lot of assumptions, right? So one is that she's talking to a straight person. I had never discussed my husband only because that wasn't the conversation. And sometimes it's instructive when people first find out that I have kids and don't immediately know that I'm in a same-sex relationship. And by the way, this happens, you know, one of the swim coaches last year, after my kids had been on the team for a long time, said something about my wife. And, I gently just said, you know, it's actually a husband. And she was very sort of embarrassed. And that doesn't so much bother me, because it's sort of, you know, most kids are being raised by, you know, a dad and a mom, right? Even this podcast isn't called, you know, Mom and Dad, or sometimes Dad and Dad, or Mom and Mom are fighting, right? I mean, it's a natural assumption to make. But the second part of it, that, you know, if you're in some other group, that just being in a place where you're kind of accepted is really all you should be looking for, you know. And I'm sure if I were to confront her with it, she would, you know, she would take it all back, right? I mean, I think she would. But it's one of those conversations you have where you're suddenly, your antenna go up and you think, you know, it's interesting what people will say when they don't know your particular situation and assume you're, and here I'll, you know, use some air quotes of my own, just like them. So I did find that interesting. And I've had encounters like that, you know, from time to time, where I'll be in a restaurant with the kids and someone will say, oh, it's mom's day off or something. And first of all, I could be a single parent, right? But I could also be in a same-sex couple. And in those cases, usually my daughters beat me to the punch and say, well, you have two dads. And then most people, in fact, everyone has been very, you know, cool with it. But it's just one of those things that's a reminder that you're not the default, and, you know, which we're not, and that's okay. But then the assumptions that accompany that are sometimes not so okay.
This is a question maybe not about being a gay dad, but about being one of two dads, which is that you have two daughters who are 13. And so I wonder how you guys collectively, individually navigate the stuff that they're going through, being girls turning into women in the world, everything from health stuff, personal stuff, to just the kind of reality of being a girl in the world. We've talked on the show in the past about how things come up for my daughter and how I very much default to her mother, who understands the experience from so many perspectives that I don't, and then kind of play a support role. And I wonder how you guys navigate through that.
That's a great question. And I guess I'll start by sort of recalling a panel that I was on some years ago. It was a panel of legal experts, and there was someone there who was, a lesbian mom who was talking about how, same-sex couples were frequently criticized because there wasn't both a man and a woman and that kids needed both, as if somehow, you know, having two moms or two dads was kind of insufficient or that there was something missing. And, you know, my take on that is pretty different. So my take on it is that no two parents are sufficient for their kids, that, you know, kids need, I really am sort of a takes a village kind of person, and that, you know, kids really need a lot of influences. And so we do sort of a combination of talking to them ourselves about, you know, what's happening. And even though obviously we haven't sort of gone through the physical piece of it, you know, we understand what it is, and, you know, it's sort of explaining to them what's involved as their bodies are changing. But they also have, you know, lots of women that they have access to who have gone through it. So luckily for us, both of our moms are still alive. They have a first cousin who lives here in Philadelphia, who is in her late 20s, I think, at this point, and they can talk to her, and she's really good about explaining things to them. We live in a twin, you know, there are lots of these twin buildings in Philadelphia. On the other side of the twin is a mom who's great with this stuff. She's very direct and funny, and she's got an older daughter as well. So it's a combination of what we know, and not feeling it's some source of inadequacy that we're bringing other people into the conversation, but feeling as if they're just getting a fuller picture by having, you know, more voices. And in terms of safety and being, you know, girls and, you know, women, we, you know, talk to them about, you know, about their bodies and their autonomy and their right to do, you know, what they want to do with them, and sort of helping them make good decisions, because they're at an age now where that's going to be very important for the next few years, and they're going to make, you know, obviously some bad decisions. That's inevitable, but trying to, you know, guide them through and being around a lot as much as we can. And I guess the only other thing I'd like to say, it's not really directly responsive, but, you know, the kids are surrounded by folks who have a mom and a dad, right? That's as true in our neighborhood as it is in most places. There's only one other family really in the neighborhood, one other gay couple that has kids. And so they are not immune from that cultural sort of influence. And they have said things to us like, well, you know, Papa, which is David, my husband, is really more like the mom. Mm-hmm. You're more like the dad. I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, what? and so I really found that interesting. And I reflected on that in one of the columns. And I'll just sort of add this little filigree to the story. I had them at the pediatrician in the last couple of months for their annual checkup. And it's a little different when they get to this age. And, you know, the pediatrician has been with them since they were, you know, babies, and was having sort of a different conversation about them and their bodies and all kinds of things about, you know, reaching adolescence. And somehow the subject of who's more like a mom and a dad came up. And this pediatrician is gay. And I said, oh, yeah, the girl said something like, I was more the dad and David was more the mom. And the pediatrician said, yeah, I agree with that. I'm like, wait a minute. You're supposed to agree with this. You're supposed to say it's horrible. But it was kind of funny. I didn't take offense at it. I thought, you know, in terms of the roles that are expected and the actions that are expected, I guess, you know, David looks more like a mom in that sense. He's probably the one that has more conversations with them about, you know, about issues involving their body. But I'm more about sort of the empowerment stuff, and not just because I took them to see Wonder Woman and Battle of the Sexes, but because, you know, whether it's, you know, I'm a big tennis fan. So if we're watching tennis, you know, half the time it's women, and I'm saying, look, you know, look at those women and what they're able to do. And I'm trying to give them, you know, the idea that, you know, there's power in their, you know, physical and their emotional states and all of those things that I hope dads are doing with their daughters and not just moms doing, you know, whether or not David is more mom than I am, we should be doing it anyway. It's a challenge, and I sort of welcome the opportunity to try to figure it out with them. And they're pretty good about, especially one of our daughters, about telling us what's going on, which at least so far, which has been great.
John Culhane, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it was great. I really appreciate it. And, I hope I answered all your questions.
John Culhane is a professor of constitutional law in Philadelphia and the author of the Hey Daddy column in Slate. We will post those columns that we discussed on our Facebook page at facebook.com/momanddadarefighting.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey, Care and Feeding listeners, it's me, Lucy Lopez. What do ASMR, AI chatbots, and diet culture all have in common? They are all topics explored on Embodied, the Ambi Award-winning weekly podcast from WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio. Each week, acclaimed reporter Anita Rao holds up her journalistic lens to all kinds of things that are sometimes hard to talk about, like sex, health, and relationships. Embodied dives into what some consider taboo to answer important questions about our bodies and our society. Nothing's off limits. Hear from expert guests, including doctors, historians, and psychologists, as they break down everything from the dynamics of egg donation, how couples combat mental health struggles like schizophrenia and OCD, and the profits and pitfalls of the self-care industry. If you need a place to start, I highly recommend checking out the recent episode where Anita interviewed two couples who continued to choose each other after one partner came out as trans. So go ahead, follow Embodied and get new episodes every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. We have now a question from a listener. This question came in through our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. If you have a question for us, you could leave it there. You could give us a call at 424-255-7833. In this case, the voice you will hear reading the question is not that of the listener. It's that of our producer, Benjamin Frisch.
I've been in a step-parenting role with my fiancé's two daughters for the past 4 years. We have an amazing relationship, and my partner and I very much split parenting duties and tasks because that's what works for our family. Even after 4 years, I still struggle with his ex-wife to be seen as a legitimate parent in any way. My partner is constantly criticized any time I'm alone with the kids during his visitation time, like when work obligations fall on a Saturday afternoon. I'm not allowed to pick up the kids for their time with daddy, even though my schedule and proximity would make it easier for me to do so and make logistics simpler. I'm never sure when I or we should push back or just exist under her rules. It makes me foster a lot of resentment towards her in ways that feel like poison. I would love to hear more about your thoughts on step-parenting and how to navigate the complicated relationships that exist in these families. Keep up the good work.
Did she say how old the daughters are?
She did not. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, it makes a difference.
She did not say how old they were.
Yeah, it really makes a difference because, you know, I would say that when you have this kind of relationship with your stepkids and you actually are there for them and you're really participating fully, over time, it becomes in the other parent's interest to not shit on you and your role in the parenting process, because the kids end up forming like a real relationship with you. And so this mom is making a mistake. I mean, you know, I'm a big proponent of boundaries with stepkids and their, you know, biological parents versus step parents. I think we've talked about it on the show before. But in this case, it is her dad's, it's the daughter's dad's parenting choice to let you participate in the kids' lives and be there for them and supervise them and take them places and go to their activities and play a parenting role. That's his parenting choice. So it's kind of between the two of them as parents to work it out or not work it out. But I would hate for you to be deterred in your interest in participating. And my instincts say that over time this will change depending on the age of the kids. But also that to some extent you can do things that look like they're being deferential to the mom. Like you can, figure out some way to set up a channel where she feels like she's in the know when the kids are going to, you know, have you be watching them or something. I mean, there are ways you can do it that are subtle, that are not actually being deferential, but have the appearance of deference. Because really, this is on your fiance. This is a decision he's making. He trusts you. You guys have a good relationship. You're nurturing to his kids, and it's okay with him that you be with them when he's at work. So as far as you're concerned, that's kind of where it should end. Obviously, that comes into play if the kids are aware of this dynamic between their mom and their dad, and that's not cool. And those are the kinds of things that they don't always work themselves out, but they do change, and often for the better, as the kids get older. At some point, this mom is going to see, when you're around for, you know, 5 years and then 10 years and then 15 years, that there's nothing to win by crapping on someone that her kids also love. So it's a complicated situation, and it sucks. It totally sucks. There's no perfect answer, but I would say don't back off the parenting. Be deferential to the mom when you can, especially when it makes a difference in terms of communication. But just know that, like, this is her dad's parenting choice, and it's not your fault that you're being marginalized by this other person. And, you know, I just keep loving the kids and keep doing what you can for them.
Is there, Rebecca, do you think, like, is there a set of stuff that is the prerogative of the parent, and then another set of stuff that where, like, you want to tell the parent to step off? How would you characterize that distinction?
Yeah, there is. And again, this is very age oriented, right? So my stepdaughter, Lily, it's actually interesting this question should come up today, because she and her dad had an argument yesterday that he told me about. And then I texted her today and said, hey, you know, I hear you. Your dad told me that you're pretty pissed at him, and I get it. You know, what he was describing to me sounded very much like, you know, parenting, child stuff, but I actually recognized it as just like her being frustrated at something that's just like a Kevin thing. So I was able to talk to her and be like, you know, hey, I get it. You know, your dad is frustrating in this way sometimes. I understand, but like, I'm really glad that you're willing to, you know, try to reach out to him and talk to him, and don't worry about the whole like argument part of it. He's fine with it. I'm fine with it, and blah, 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 blah. Now, this is something, a conversation we couldn't have had, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, because it's very much in the parent's purview to deal with sort of the upset and the crises of the kids, because that's like very close to home. I mean, in terms of logistical things that are in the parents' purview, like meeting with teachers is very much a thing that falls in the parents' purview, doctor's appointments, you know, parenting choices around all kinds of, you know, nutrition, you know, all that stuff, it sort of defer to the parents. But what she's talking about here is just basic care, right? Like being there, watching the kids, you know, being with them on a Saturday, not babysitting, actually being with them and supervising them in a parental role. I mean, she's engaged to this guy. She's going to be their stepmom. I don't know. I think the mom is making a mistake in not trying to at least work with this couple a little more. And it's a mistake that I know that I've made in small ways, that my ex-husband and his wife made, and that my stepmom's mom. This is a common mistake, but I do think when the kids are younger, it's just a lot more complicated, because there's like mom and dad, and you feel like you're the threat of being replaced. But I mean, I'm guessing these kids don't feel like the stepmom is their mom. I'm guessing that they know it's a stepmom, and it bums me out to hear this, but it is so common. And yeah, there are boundaries, but basic care on a Saturday is not one of those boundaries, as far as I'm concerned. Unless there's something in the parenting plan or divorce decree that says that. I mean, sometimes there is. Like, if my kids are going to be without their biological parent for 4 hours, I get the prerogative to, you know, to take them instead of them being cared for by someone else. Sometimes that's actually written in, and that might be the case here. But otherwise, you know, I think it's just hang in there and try to brush this off as much as possible, and don't take it out on the kids. Just love them.
I think that if you and your fiance feel really strongly that something has to happen logistically, like, no, she has to be able to pick up the kids, that falls on him to have that conversation with his ex, not on you.
Yep.
That's outside of your purview, too. So really all you have here is to continue doing what it sounds like you're doing, which is to develop and maintain a consistent, loving relationship with the children. And the rest, as painful as it is, to let the chips fall where they may. And I guess I want to address one last thing, which is that you talked about the way that your resentment is making it difficult for you. That is also something. I mean, resentment makes things difficult for us. And we have to find ways to be free of resentment, even when it's justified. Even when we have been wronged by someone, we still have to find ways for our own safety and operational sort of ability. We have to find ways to be free of resentment. So that's the other work that you can do, is like finding ways to let go of the fact, to if not agree with her, at least accept that she has some reason that this is very hard for her, and that she's struggling, and that she's in pain, and that she's uncomfortable. And it might not be justified. Her behavior might be way out of the fucking pocket. But at the same time, that she's struggling very hard for something. And it's kind of sad when you think about it. So that's one of the ways that I work through when I have justified resentments towards other people.
That was the one thing that I wanted to pick up on. The letter writer says something that I think is really perceptive. She says, it makes me foster a lot of resentment toward her in ways that feel like poison. And I think that's right, that those feelings do become poison, not just in the relationship between the stepmother and the mother, but in the family, like between the stepmother and the kids, between the stepmother and the father who may not be doing enough or may not seem to be doing enough or whatever. And that is poison. That corrodes what's good in our relationships with one another. I have a suggestion for the, and I think the letter writer is right to identify that as the problem, to identify that poison as the problem, separate from the separate from the mother's irrational and unpleasant behavior. I have a suggestion about that that's maybe the opposite of what Carvel says, which is, to whatever extent you can try to sympathize with her. You can try to understand that she's presumably coming from a place of pain, that it's difficult for her to see her former husband remarried, maybe that it's difficult for her to see somebody else taking care of her kids. Everybody has their pain and it's hard. At the same time, it might be more helpful in managing that resentment to think of her more instrumentally and less as a human being. That is, if you can think of her just as an obstacle, as a thing that you have to work around, as a thing that makes demands that make your life more difficult, but that are not, that you don't need to sympathize with or oppose or have feelings about, other than, well, this is inconvenient that I don't get to pick the kids up from school, even though I'm much closer to where the kids go to school. That you might have an easier time if you just think, well, this is the board. This is the lay of the land. This is the status quo, is that we have to adapt our routines to these difficult circumstances that this other person is making. And yet our family can make those accommodations. Our family can, you know, my husband can do the picking up, even though it's more of a schlep for him. We can try to organize things so that they don't set off some kind of a firestorm. When we can't do that, then there's going to be a firestorm, and we're just going to tolerate the firestorm as though that's the weather. And if you can minimize your investment in the mother's feelings, it might turn out paradoxically to help manage that resentment and let you concentrate on what you can really do, which is, as Rebecca said, focus on the love you feel for the kids and for your husband and on making a good family.
Yeah, I had a really adversarial relationship with one of the other parents in my system for a long time. And I did very much what you're saying, Gabe, although I didn't think about it that way. For me, it was very much like I used like the third party mentality. But the way you articulated it beautifully, I think. The other thing that I thought about a lot is that, you know, I had to, just because I was always talking to children who were very often with this person, I had to force myself to find ways to be positive and relate to their experiences, or even just who they were as a person. So I would find myself, you know, asking the kids like really innocuous questions about things like food and things like trips or whatever, just to sort of in my mind really humanize this other parent a little bit and see them through my kids' eyes. Because the thing that's so important here, which I think is implied but we haven't said explicitly, is I don't care if your kid, your stepkid's mother is like one of the, you know, Manson girls or whatever. You do not want to cross that line where you where the kids pick up that there is that poisonous feeling toward their mom. You cannot do that, because that will like unalterably shift the relationship somewhere not good, especially when they start to really pick up on what's going on. And they will. They 100% will. So you have to find things that your kids love about their mom that you can, even if you don't genuinely love them, appreciate and pretend to love. And that is the foundation of your communication with the kids about their mom, because that poison so easily can come into that relationship, and that will ruin everything for everyone, like guaranteed.
Yep.
All right. We should move on. I hope that was helpful. Letter writer, let us know. Time for recommendations. Carvel, what do you recommend?
I am recommending another blast from the past, which is a show that we used to watch when the kids were little, like preschool aged. And I think it's still available maybe on Netflix. I know it used to be. I don't know if it is or not. But it's the 2007, I guess, to still present Word Girl, the PBS television show about the unassuming average fifth grader Becky Botsford, who, when duty calls, is transformed into Word Girl, flying to the rescue using vocabulary to stop the bad guys, along with her trusty sidekick, Captain Huggy Face, who is a monkey. this show, it was one of the few like kids shows that my kids loved and I loved, and I don't know, it just was great. And so if you have kids that are in that age range where they're still interested in television shows about superheroes who use vocabulary, kind of an updated Letterman type situation, I would recommend Word Girl, a PBS series that I think is still running.
I am definitely going to be watching that. I'm going to recommend a kid's picture book that we found in the yellow room where Leo has been going to school. And ever since we stopped reading Owl Babies, which I talked about a couple of weeks ago, we've been reading Mr. Gumpy's Outing by John Birmingham. And it is very charming. It's an English picture book about an old farmer with a boat who goes for a ride down the river and winds up acquiring more and more animals. When you describe these things, they don't always, it's hard to capture the particular charm and humor and magic of this one. But it's a lovely picture book. And if you have young kids, you should check it out. Mr. Gumpy's Outing by John Birmingham. Rebecca.
Sounds so cute, Mr. Gumpy's Outing. I'm going to recommend, and I'm going to use a name brand, but I don't think it matters what name brand you use, music sharing service. My chosen one is Spotify Family, because for a relatively low price, I'm able to hook all my kids up with accounts, and then we can share and create music lists. And what I'm really loving about it right now is that I'm able to create lists that my kids can check out and pull off of. They're able to share lists with me. You know, Henry's basically making like mixtape lists for his friends or his girlfriend, and then I like check it out and pull songs off of it. And I wish I had had this and this existed when my kids were really little. And, you know, you'd have to find things to listen to in the car that everyone could tolerate, because it would have been so great to build a list of, you know, the goofy kids songs they liked, and then like throw a few like Beatles tunes in there and like the stuff that, you know, to try to like wean them off of the goofy kids songs, and, you know, to do it collaboratively with kids. But it really, really is cool to check out what your kids are listening to create lists for them, to, you know, just be able to collaborate in that way, sharing music and giving the list silly names. And we're really just enjoying it. And what's so great about the sharing services now is that you can be anywhere, and as long as you have this app on your phone, you can listen to anybody's lists, you can make new ones on the fly, and if you're all connected together, share them. It's just, it's been really, really fun. This is something we've only been doing for a few months, and I'm loving it.
I want to say we totally depend on Spotify for all of our household music, and my kids most recently have gotten into what's called Your Daily Mix, where Spotify like puts together a bunch of songs, and what they love is it's all the same songs that we listen to literally every day, but in a different order. And it's so exciting for them. I'm like, you guys, it's literally the Moana soundtrack and the My Little Pony soundtrack. And they're like, I know. Can you believe it? They're so excited.
Magic.
Yeah, it really is. That's machine learning for you. And that's our show. If you have a question that you would like us to address, you can give us a call at 424-255-7833. Let us know what you thought of the show, what you think of us, what you think of our children on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. This show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth, and we'll be back next week on Mom and Dad Are Fighting.